Hey, what's good, folks? This is Rich, and we're still off for the month of July, but wanted to share a past episode, another Pond the Replay, since this one goes back to spring of 2017, and it feels just as timely today. And if you're in or around Philly, or plan to be in Philly on July 21st, 2018, don't forget to RSVP for our first ever meetup and chill event. You can do so by visiting PayBal, PayBal.co/Philly, PHILLY. Again, that's PayBal.co/Philly to RSVP. Now, a couple of quick technical notes about this episode. The first 4 minutes are a little bit scratchy, and then everything is fine after that. Also spared y'all an ad in the middle, so you'll hear us say that we're going to take a break, and then we don't. And then we also took out some of the outdated stuff at the end of the show after we finish up with the guest so that people wouldn't be confused. So we hope you enjoy this replay, and we'll see you in August, or maybe again in July. Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, a weekly podcast where we cover work and money for the millennial professional. Switched it up on them, brother.
I forgot to do my tip of the tongue, roof of the mouth exercises, but I think I can get through this tongue twister. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. And a few episodes back, we discussed the story of the couple with two kids that only had $7,000 left from their $500,000 household income at the end of each year. We read a lot of strong opinions on this one, and we thought it'd be good to reach out to the author of that post for a fun discussion here on P&B. But we ended up talking about a lot of other money and work topics.
And after this conversation, we'll close it out with another edition of Q&A. But first, we hope you enjoy our chat with the man behind Financial Samurai.
Today, we're joined by the notorious Financial Samurai. He has spent over 10 years working in the finance industry, got his MBA from Cal. He's invested and he saved. If you read the bumper stickers, he was living the American dream. But after 13 years of working in corporate America, money ceased to be a major driving factor. Instead, living absolutely free became his biggest motivation.
It's motivation.
He fantasized about what it would be like to write, spend time with the family, and travel with little financial worries. 3 years after starting FinancialSamurai.com in 2009, he took the leap of faith, and now he joins us here today. Thanks for coming on the show, Mr. Samurai, and may I call you Sam?
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. Rich, any more ad-libs that you would like to awkwardly drop?
Cheer! That's it. And I hope that wasn't too loud in everyone's ears, but I was kind of waiting to do that.
I wonder about that sometimes. So I tried to highlight your background to the best of my abilities, but is there anything that I missed that did not do justice?
No, I guess what else? I grew up overseas in Asia and in Zambia because my parents were in the Foreign Service. So I was overseas until high school, where I came to Virginia. And then I went to William & Mary for undergrad and then went to New York in 99 to hit the grind.
How was that transition? Was Virginia the best representation? How was that?
Virginia's great. I mean, I went to high school in Northern Virginia. And so William & Mary is only 2 hours south in Williamsburg, and it was interesting times because I remember really clearly when I was about 14 years old that we weren't rich. We lived in a really modest townhouse, whereas a lot of friends lived in single-family homes that were quite large. And my sister had gone to a private school. It was Smith College. It was like $25,000 a year at the time, and I just thought that was crazy. Especially since I knew how much my parents made. They worked in the government and they didn't make that much. And so it was kind of from very early on where I was really cognizant about money. And so I decided to go to William & Mary because it was only $2,800 a year in tuition. And I knew that if all else failed, if I graduated with no job, I could pay it off going back to work at McDonald's.
Is that a conversation? So you said you became cognizant about money early on, and that's something a lot of our, I feel like, listeners, and honestly some of our guests as well, didn't have with their parents. Is that an open conversation that you had with your parents?
You know, I just saw my parents as always really frugal. You know, when we go out to eat, they would order water with lemon, you know, and when I asked for some kind of drink, they would say, let's just stick with water. So I thought that was quite interesting from a very early age. Also living overseas in Malaysia, Taiwan, you saw a lot of poverty. So you saw a lot of wealth and juxtaposed with a lot of poverty. And so I had friends who, like a family of four, would live in a studio apartment with bunk beds all along the room. And then they'd all eat in the center of the room as well. And then I would go back to my government-provided housing as a diplomat. And I was like, wow, that's like so different from what I could ever imagine. So I think it all probably started more when I was like 11, 12, when I was living overseas in Malaysia. And when I came to the States, you know, we really lived quite humbly. We had like a 8-year-old Toyota Camry. I remember asking my dad, could you buy a Toyota Celica instead? And he said no. And could I have a car? And he said no. But then finally, I was able to get like a $2,100 Toyota Corolla hatchback, which is kind of beat up with a funky door.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it was, we were so really comfortable. We had everything we wanted, stable household, but I knew we weren't rich. I knew what rich was, and we definitely weren't that. So I felt, you know, it was, I felt like there was like this onus to be responsible at a really, really early age.
So definitely appreciate you sharing that with us. And on your site here, and maybe this is all interrelated, you have, I pulled a quote from it that said, I knew I wouldn't be able to last a lifetime working 70 plus hours a week. Do you want to share, or do you remember what your aha moment was? Like, when did that realization come to you?
Yeah, the aha moment was probably the first week of work in 1999. We had to get in by 5:30 in the morning, and we would stay until like 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. every single night. I worked in institutional sales and trading at Goldman Sachs.
That sounds very Wall Street of you.
Yeah, it's One New York Plaza. I walked to work in the dark, and I walked home in the dark. So it was always dark, and I just remember thinking, man, 14-hour work days, that's 70 hours a week, plus probably like another 5 to 6 hours on the weekends. This is like brutal. I don't think I can make it. And I also felt really lucky that I got the job in the first place, because William & Mary wasn't a target school, but I went to a conference and I got lucky getting to know a recruiter, and I was invited back for Super Day, and like literally, I think it was like 7 rounds of interviews. It was ridiculous. So I felt really lucky, one. And then two, I realized, man, work is just too brutal that I had to save and invest right away so I can one day have the optionality to be free.
So I've always wanted to meet one of these guys from the movies, and maybe this is my opportunity. Did you literally work in mergers and acquisitions, which I guess just is a fantasy world that I've never been able to been exposed to? Is that you? Are you really that guy? Are you the guy from the movie?
No,
mergers and acquisitions?
No, I'm the equities guy. I'm on the sales and trading desk where people are throwing phones, yelling. You know, like the guys, you know, talking to clients and stuff.
I think
that was really cool.
I always think of Blender Room when I hear this side of it.
So close.
The amazing thing is that it's really, so Hollywood has definitely Hollywoodized Wall Street. Boiler Room are the places where people go who didn't go to Wall Street, right? Those are the guys who are just, you know, calling mom and pop and trying to scam people, right? That's Boiler Room. But Wall Street is really, it's a really rigid structure. There's mergers and acquisitions, corporate finance, there's equity sales and trading, prime brokerage, all this stuff. And it's really a structured and well-complianced organization where it's nothing like Wolf of Wall Street and all that. So all these shops, like whatever, from Wolf of Wall Street, those are shops that you would never join if you actually had any kind of credibility or background, right? But what happens is that the movies make it seem like that's what a JP Morgan is, or a Morgan Stanley or whatever. But these are two separate worlds, like absolutely different. But that said, it was a really fun time, really interesting culture. You know, I was interviewing with Goldman in 1998. And joined them right when they went public. So they were a private firm, the last of the great, or the large private bulge bracket shops they were private until 99. So the culture was really cool. There's a lot of training. There's a lot of mentorship. And it gave you a lot of confidence to be able to do things if you put your mind to it.
Now, are you surprised by any of what happened in 2008, 2009 with the financial market, just based on your experience? And of course, you had started in the industry, earlier, but then of course I know you started blogging around 2009, but were you surprised to see what happened in 2008, 2009, as far as the whole stock market collapse?
No, because, when I joined in 99, that was a year and a half basically before the dot-com bubble, right? So in March 2000. So that was a massive hemorrhage. And so I wasn't really surprised because I really witnessed a lot of greed just from Main Street, really, from everybody. But the housing crisis, you know, affected everyone because it's something like 68% of Americans own homes. Mm-hmm. But I think what was interesting is that there was a lot of blame on Wall Street for the housing crisis. And as a homeowner myself, in equities, I had nothing to do with selling you a mortgage or a house, but I was getting crushed as well with a neighbor who was foreclosing. And so it was a really strange time because, you know, it was like always who to blame for not paying my bills. And so I've always grew up always honoring my bills and my debt without failure. Like no matter what, I will pay you back. I will never blame someone else for me not paying what I owe someone. And so there was a lot of interesting times where the finance firms had to be blamed, the insurance companies had to be blamed, and then eventually the government had to be blamed. But I thought, like, really introspectively, you know, part of starting Financial Summer in 2009 was, hey, maybe we should just kind of take a look at ourselves and take the responsibility for ourselves to see how we can improve ourselves. Because we can blame people all we want, or we can try to bring someone down to get to our level. But that's not really going to help us.
Right.
And so the site is really just was a cathartic way to deal with the massive financial loss that I experienced and many other people experienced. You know, I thought I did everything right. I saved aggressively. I diversified, and I still lost probably 35 to 40% of my net worth in a matter of 10 months, maybe. And yeah, just from there, just kind of built a community and went forward.
And, you know, not limited to our listeners, but I think we all like to hear success stories of escaping what I'm going to label the matrix. If someone wanted to put their escape plan together, what are your top three or five recommendations? If you have one, that's fine, because my follow-up question would be, and what is the priority of that list?
I think people just kind of go through work and life not really having a detailed plan. One of the things that I tell everybody is if the amount of money you're saving each week or month is not hurting you, you're not saving enough. I mean, you've got to feel some pain to be able to make a difference in your life. We kind of go through life really like zombies. And I was fortunate to just get crushed my very first week of work and get crushed by the massive pressure of the industry that I realized I had to make a change in my finances. I had to be disciplined. Whereas if you get a really nice cushy job, you know, maybe it's 8 to 5, 8 to 6, you have an hour lunch break, nobody's harassing you, you don't have strong metrics to achieve, you're gonna go through life for like 10 to 15, 20 years, pretty okay, but you're never gonna really accelerate. And then one day you're gonna wake up and you'll be like, wow, I gotta get out of this. This is all my life is. So having a lot of pain is really great for financial freedom. Work pain, any kind of pain, money pain, it just really motivates you to hustle.
That's an interesting concept, because as far as the saving part, that you're not saving enough unless it
hurts.
Yeah, that's I never heard that before. So that's just an interesting way to look at it for me, that you should be feeling some type of pain, and that's what's going to tell you that you're doing well.
Yeah, then you're making progress. It's the same thing with working out. No pain, no gain, right? If you're not ripping your muscles, you're not growing your muscles. So from a financial perspective, I think what happens is a lot of people go through like maybe 10 years of work And then they're like, oh, I hate my job. I want to change my life. But then they don't got anything to show for in terms of savings or passive income. Mm-hmm. So the key is to actually have some foresight into realizing that in 5 or 10 years, you are going to be sick of your job. I pretty much guarantee it for like 90% of the people out there. Definitely in 10 years, you're going to be sick of doing the same old thing. And you need to have some options. And the options are developed through savings, investing, and generating passive income so that you won't starve when you kind of try to do something new. And you won't be afraid. You won't be so afraid that you just never make a change. There's a great saying, this is during the financial crisis. I got to know a really good guy. He worked the front desk. He was the mailroom guy. He was 56 years old. His name was Conrad. And I talked to him every day for like 8 years. Hey, what's up? How you doing? You know, he liked to collect stuff on eBay. I was like, what are you collecting today? He told me something. He said, you regret more of the things you don't do than the things you try, basically. And then the very next day, he got laid off.
Oof.
Yeah. And so that really kind of, and that was basically early 2012 when I was trying to engineer my layoff. And that really spoke to me. You know, 56-year-old guy, he probably only made $35,000 to $40,000, not a huge cost center relative to what other people were making. And they just let him go. And to me, that was really a bitter moment where I felt, you know what, I got to go.
That's a tough one. And I know it actually reminds me, Marcus, of that story you told a while back where you were sitting, I think it was a bar or some type of establishment with libations, and an older gentleman was talking to you about work.
First of all, let me clarify that this was a fully clothed establishment in which beverage of the adult variety were being offered. But yes, it's funny you say that because I was thinking that exact same story. And there was a guy celebrating his retirement. He was sitting across the bar from me. He was talking to me and maybe a guy in his 20s. So I'm 34. And we were telling him, you know, congratulations. And, you know, what did your coworkers say? And he's saying the one thing that I share with them and through all those congratulatory remarks was, I did it wrong, guys. I waited for retirement to come to me instead of racing towards retirement. And yeah, same thing. That was really, I mean, here he is. I mean, you think you've hit the mountaintop. Like that's the mountaintop. I'm going to retire. Yeah. And you know, you start thinking about all the commercials where you're sitting in the two tubs for some reason on the beach, and you start like fantasizing, like that's what I'm striving for. It's 65. I can't wait. And to hear that from, I assume, this 65-year-old gentleman to say, I should have gotten here quicker, or I shouldn't have waited and not been proactively for it to approach. And I think that's what you're saying here. So that some of that temporary pain, so you can actually enjoy it when you are young. And another article that we spoke to is multiple retirements. So millennials or younger generations may be saying that I want to do something different now. And through this savings, investing in passive income, if it's available to you and planned correctly, you know, I can stop now. I'll take a break. I'm going to take a 5-10 year break. I don't know that we'll have a retirement anymore. I don't know that if that's really the vision plan that many of us are working towards anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've been in the blog game since 2009. So when did that really start to get moving for you? Because I know right now I still see a lot of the, I started a blog, connected it to Pinterest, and next thing you know, I owned a jet, or I started a blog and then I worked hard for 6 months, and then next thing you know, I own a house and I rode a plane. So when did things really get moving for you after you started the blog?
So, you know, I like to write and I like to connect with people. I was the kid, you know, 13 years old, 12 years old, who had pen pals, international pen pals, back then when handwriting was actually normal. Ooh. And sending letters. And it was really cool. And I still have all my pen pal letters from back when I was 12 to 13 years old in this box. So I just started writing, and I think things really started picking up after about 6 months. So I started this challenge. It was called the Yakezi Challenge. If you can write consistently for two to four times a week, publish 2 to 4 times a week, and breach 200,000 in Alexa, the ranking system, you basically were able to join the Yakezi network, which is this blog network that I started, which is not functioning too much anymore. But it was just a fun thing to do. So 6 months was a really good turning point where things started to pick up, where people started to notice my site. 1 year, a little bit better. And after about 2.5 years, it started making a livable income stream in San Francisco. And I don't know what it was, but it was consistency. It was, I basically published 3 to 4 times a week, every week for 2.5 years. And I was just motivated to get out. And I didn't know what was my next step after finance. But after about a year, I thought, hey, this could be it. And I actually have a funny story to tell you later on, I guess, in fall of 2011, what was my big turning point?
Hey, I mean, you can tell the story now, or I mean, we could wait and go through. I was already waiting for it. I was like, oh, here comes the story. And then I was just sitting
there. Oh, okay. Oh, wait. You had a question. I was
leaning off my chair like, yeah, cliffhanger.
Well, the story is, so I started in 2009, and the fall of 2011, I was in Santorini, Greece. I was just hiking around with my wife. And I came to the top of the crater, amazing view, 78-degree day. And I had my iPhone, like, I guess, one of the first versions back then. And there was Wi-Fi, which was also really rare kind of back then, at the top of the crater. And so I went into this bar, ordered like a $10 beer, because that's all they had. It was like a Mykonos beer. And in came a message from someone in London who said, hey, Sam, I want to advertise on your site. Are you available? And I was like, oh yeah, actually I'm closer to you now than I was just a couple weeks ago back in San Francisco. What do you have in mind? And he said, well, I'd like to advertise this link on your site for 1 year and I'll pay you $1,200. And I said, oh really? Hey, that sounds pretty good. And so he sent me the code. I put it up on my site with my mobile phone. Back then that was pretty cool. And he sent me $1,200 via PayPal within 30 minutes. And I said, damn, that's sweet. And so I said, hey, waiter, give me another $10 beer. And so this was the fall of 2011. And I said, you know what? Maybe I won't starve if I leave. Maybe I can do something different and fun. Yes, I won't make as much money, but this is just so much fun. And so that's when the wheels started turning, where I was like, okay, if I can just negotiate a severance package after being at this firm for 11 years, I'm out of here. And so I got back in November, and then in January, I initiated the discussion with my managers about trying to negotiate some kind of package so we can all be on good terms, so I can provide a smooth transition. And we agreed to some great terms. I got all my deferred compensation, a private investment that had a 7-year invest that I made in 2010, and all that stuff, and a severance. And so I left on March 8th, 2012.
Nice. So you said something there. You negotiated a severance package. So you didn't You didn't have to leave. You very much could have stayed, kept working. And I'm sure there are people who are listening to this like, wait, negotiated a severance package? Like you got them to give you one for leaving on your own terms?
Yeah. So this is what happens when you're a loyal soldier, right? I was there for 11 years. I was a relatively senior employee, not that senior, but executive director, right? I was relatively senior, 11-year dedication. I had built a really strong network internally with Asia, New York, and San Francisco. And I provided a lot of revenue. So I generated more than I cost. And that's something key that every employee should recognize. As soon as you're generating less than you cost, you're fired. Right. So never overestimate or underestimate yourself. Just know your worth. So I was probably generating about 10 times what I cost at my firm. And I was also well connected with my client base. So the key really is to have a negotiation where you say, hey, I'm a cost center to you, even though I generate good revenue. But I think you guys could save a lot of heartache by letting me go instead of someone who doesn't want to go. And I can, in the next 2-3 months, I can rapidly train my subordinate, who I actually hired 2 years ago, to cover my accounts and do the work that I was doing, so that we will have a seamless and smooth transition. And you're going to save a lot of money, and you're going to save a lot of pain by letting someone go. So it's like a win-win-win-win-win situation. And in return, all I want is a severance based on what other people have got before, plus all my deferred cash and stock and an old partner investment that was made in 2010. And at the end of the day, they said, sure, why not? Because they want to take care of the people who took care of them. And a company nowadays, they really focus on reputation, right? With social media, the internet, you can blow up someone like Susan Fowler blew up Uber regarding that sexism Medium post. This other woman blew up another company. People are blowing companies up left and right. It's not really great for their own careers unless they're already financially independent. But it's really key to realize that as an employee, especially an employee with at least 3 to 5 years of experience, you have more rights than you know. Never quit, get laid is my motto for the book that I wrote on engineering layoff. Never quit, always get laid, right?
Right. Off that.
Because
is.
If you quit, yeah, exactly. Because if you quit, the company's like, sweet, sweet, you quit. I don't have to give you severance. There's no unemployment benefits filing. You know, there's no deferred comp. You lose all your stock options, everything. See you later. Thank you, idiot, for quitting. And so I've been trying to teach people since 2012 to take ownership, to not take the easy way out and just say, I'm gone. But actually have a conversation. Have a conversation with your manager, your HR professional, and say, hey, can we work something out? Because I think we can.
Mm. And so what about for folks that aren't in money generating functions? So, for example, you were directly tied to how much money that the company made in terms of being kind of more in more of a I'll call it more of a sales type of function. You were on the sales floor, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And so there are people that are in HR recruiting like myself. They're in other functions that may not be revenue generating. How should they change the way they approach that conversation, given that they may not be able to say, I generated 200K for the company last year, or a million, or 5 million. Is there anything different that, or a different leverage point that they can use to have that same compensation or that same conversation?
Absolutely. So again, it goes back to, you're only there because you generate more value than you cost, right? So know your value. You don't have to generate 200,000, 1 million, 10 million for the firm. It's all relative, right? So if your value is that you've been able to hire 10 awesome employees who proceeded to generate X amount of value, that's what your value is. You're not going to be there if you're not generating more value than your cost. So just know what you are worth, know what you provide to the company, and have that conversation. Don't sell yourself short.
And one thing I want to ask is, it was definitely on my mind, and I think it's something in different variations that someone has told me, is that you don't go to the people in your current job to talk about leaving your job, because usually, as you said, those people are thinking in a box that they can't even relate to. So when you got back from Greece, and this probably sounded insane at the time, you told them you updated from the top of the mountain on your mobile phone, your blog in 2009. What did the naysayers say, and how did you still move on beyond it? Because I'm sure they were like, what?
Yeah.
I remember. So how'd you get behind it?
I remember we had like a team dinner, and one of the junior guy, he was a VP, he was one level below me in finance. I said, hey, I got this blog, and I think I want to blog, right, for a living. And then he immediately threw up his fingers in the air and did like a funny face with and started typing air keyboard style, right?
Oh, I thought it was the middle fingers up in the air. I was like, wow, that escalated.
No, he was just like air keyboard. Oh, you can start a blog, blah, 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 right? And I was like, wow, right? And, but the funny thing is I did it, and it's probably generating way more than he is, and he's still stuck. And I think he got laid off.
Ooh.
Nobody knows, like nobody, the greatest thing is nobody will really ever believe in you as much as you can believe in yourself. So, yeah, it's fun.
Nice.
Yeah, and I was actually trying to get this in front of me because cornerly, but yet actively, it does help me. I collect quotes from the internet, usually memes. And one of them is, I was able to find it. Everyone has ideas, but effective execution, that's a skill. It takes dedication and discipline to execute, and everyone does not have that.
Yeah. If you do something there's a great Chinese saying, and it goes, if the direction is correct, sooner or later, you will get there. And that's really poignant to me, because just knowing that I will get somewhere is motivation enough to try hard. Whether I get there sooner or later, it doesn't matter. But I know if I try harder, there will be some kind of correlation. The problem with a lot of work is a disconnect with correlation with effort and reward. So for example, during the financial crisis, a lot of us worked harder and we were rewarded less. Or if you're like a top three revenue generator with a particular client, it didn't really matter because you had to subsidize money-losing departments. And I understood that it's important to be a part of the Borg so you can survive and thrive together.
So I know what that means, but you might want to break down that Borg comment.
Oh, Borg is just, what is it, Star Trek? Where it's just like the Borg assimilated into this. It's like the Matrix, right?
Oh, and I'm sitting here thinking like Borg. I'm like, board of directors? Board of, what's this board? I'm going to ask Borg. Marcus about this board.
B-O-R-G.
Got it.
And so the Borg. Got to get out of the Borg.
I know we have a couple more things to cover, in particular the article that sent the world into a frenzy, or at least Facebook. I made that sound real dramatic by saying the whole world, but we're going to take a quick break and come right back. And we're back.
So at this point, I think we're going to transition to the 500,000 story heard around the world. And I'm going to say it is the world, because for all intents and purposes, isn't Facebook like the size of three countries and four continents or something like that? So if it's on Facebook, I think you could safely say it's the world, especially if it's going viral on there. And that article was scraping by on 500,000 a year, why it's so hard for high income earners to escape the rat race, from our guest, financialsamurai.com. So were you surprised that this particular story went viral? I mean, when you were pinning this, when you were air keyboarding it, were you like, this is a good one, this is a winner? did you go to sleep? Because this always happens to me. It's never the tweet I expect to go viral, and then I wake up, it's like 20 plus, and the first thing I do is check my work phone and make sure there's not an email that also coincides with the viral tweet that says, you know, please come into the office. We're always worried about viral on Friday, laid off on Monday. So after I check that, I go back and see what tweet people are looking at. Was this your experience, or did you know it took off and you were prepared for it?
You know, so I wrote this post a year and a half, two years ago. Yeah, so I didn't write it in 2017.
I can't tell. You know what? It's funny, because when I look at the post, you don't have the dates on them.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't easily tell when it was written. I mean, I guess right. I could have went and looked through all of the comments, but interesting.
Right.
So someone found it and got upset, I'm guessing.
Well, so what happens if you're a good strategy as a blogger is to write evergreen content. And you write evergreen content because, one, it's relatable across a longer period of time, right? Instead of saying, hey, Netflix had great first quarter 2017 results, blah, 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 which lasts for, let's say, one day. Let's say instead you write about, you know, Netflix, the history of online streaming or something, right? So that's an evergreen type content that can last forever. So you want to, as a blogger, write about stuff that can be pertinent for as long of the time as possible, and you want to go and update it for the latest information. And so I wrote it a year and a half ago, but I updated stuff every year just to keep things current. And so I linked back to the article. I linked back to the article from another new article that I wrote, and then someone probably just clicked that link, saw it. The guy's name was Downtown Josh Brown, and then he tweeted the chart, and he linked back to my article. And that's how it started going. And I didn't expect it to go crazy, but when I published that article a year and a half ago, it received a lot of fanfare already, but not like now.
Yeah, which is insane, because he put it on Twitter, and then I actually first saw it going viral on Facebook, which was interesting.
Yeah, I don't really even do Facebook, believe it or not. So I had no idea it was going crazy on Facebook. But like the tweet count is like, I don't know, 50,000 or something. So to me, I thought Twitter was even more crazy, but I guess it was crazy on Facebook too. That's pretty cool.
Hmm. Well, I'm completely flabbergasted here, but I'll try to get back on script. So from the I kind of pulled out some of your comments, and now I'm not sure if these are new or old, but we can speak to them.
The comments have dates.
Okay. Okay. Making money as a W-2 wage is the worst way to go. Society won't acknowledge it. The sacrifices you make, the time and money you spent, and the risks you took to get to your position today. I think we've spoken a little bit about this earlier. Do you have any additional or new insights, or you know what? That's still solid.
Yeah. I mean, everything is kind of rational in my mind. If you work harder, generally you'll do a little better than the person who doesn't work harder, right? We all know, I mean, ever since high school, you know, the guy who's studying 6 hours a night is probably going to get better grades than the guy who's smoking cigarettes with his friend in the backseat of a car somewhere, right? And so, like, to get to, let's say, doctor level income, you got to be a doctor first. You got to study your butt off in high school and in college, and then you got to do 4 years of residency or something like that, 3 years of residency, and then sometimes you got to do specialty stuff. And then only then might you make like $200,000 when you're 32 years old after 10 years of school and $200,000 in debt, right? Good luck. You know, if anybody wants to make that kind of money, just be a doctor, no problem. Or if anybody wants to make, you know, the big law corporate money where you start at $160,000 at, I think, 28 years old, you can be a lawyer if you want, go ahead, but that's 3 years of $70,000 a year tuition. You're trying to get the top LSAT scores and everything, and you're just gonna kill yourself 80 hours a week. So what happens is we have a mental shortcut to say, oh, you make $300,000 or you make $500,000, your household life is good. So I wanted to really break down how that $500,000 can be spent. And you know, there's a lot of taxes involved, right?
Oh,
the more you make, there's more taxes, right? And that's kind of like, I want to tell people, hey, you may not want to work so hard and make so much because you're just going to kill yourself and pay all these taxes as a W-2 earner. And then just kind of break it down further. And these are all real expenses that have been corroborated by hundreds and hundreds of people who make similar types of income.
So can you, I think I follow that, and it might help for us to expand on that a little bit. So when you say W-2 earner, you're saying a traditional 9-to-5, and this is an open-ended question, as in comparison to the passive income or multiple income streams.
Yeah, so there's a lot of income streams that are not subject to like the FICA, Social Security, Medicare tax, i.e. dividend income. And then there's a lot of income like entrepreneurial income or freelance income like 1099. And then entrepreneurial income. So think about, let's say Amazon, you know, they lose billions of dollars. They lose money all the time, but now they're like the second most valuable company in the world. Uber is, I don't know what's the latest, 60 to 70 billion valuation, but they lose like, you know, 1 or 2 billion every year. So they're not paying any taxes, right? If you're losing money, you're not paying taxes, but their wealth is growing massive. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea of kind of trying to make money not through wages because you get taxed out the wazoo, but every which way else but wages. And most people don't realize that because most people just work wage jobs, right?
Well, it's interesting because we see, and I know this at least with millennials, and we saw this in particular with a lot of our listeners. We ran a survey a few months back, and over 80% expressed interest in some type of entrepreneurship. So there were people who were like, day job, over it, I'm ready to get out this place. And there were some people who were like, you know what? I have no problem working in corporate America. I like the stability that it provides, but I also want to put myself in a position to make some more money on the side. So what you're talking about here, it seems like this generation sort of gets that. They see that there are more opportunities to generate additional income as opposed to just working harder at work, hoping to get a pay raise, hoping to get a bigger bonus, actually taking some of that control into our own hands, even though it means that, you know, we may need to now spend our nights and weekends doing a second job.
Absolutely. So come on. I mean, let's say you get to go to work at a leisurely time, like 8 a.m., right? And you leave at 5. So you're home hopefully by 6. Man, you have so much time. You have from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m. to do a hell of a lot of stuff. Oh,
sleep?
My God.
That's, sleep? What about sleep?
5 hours? 6 hours? Okay, so let's say Let's say you got 12 hours to do whatever you want. So let's take 6 hours for sleep. That's 6 hours left. And then 2 hours for doing nothing. So you got 4 hours. You got 4 hours to do something awesome, some side hustle, build your brand online. Everybody should have their own website, first of all, to have their brand. You know, why let Facebook or Twitter get rich off your brand? Why don't you just get rich off your own brand, right?
Right.
And you have so much stuff you can do in 3 to 4 hours every single day. And if you find something that you like to do, man, it doesn't feel like work at all. So, but think about it. What do most people do after they get off work? They watch TV, they watch Netflix.
Most single people, yes. People with families, I know it's a little bit different.
Yeah, of course. Spend time with their family and all that. But then even if you have family and kids, the kids are not going to sleep past 10 p.m. You know, you can go from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Amazing time to do some great work.
And another thing, and now that I look back, I don't know why we started so ominously, but we literally, our first episode, I'm looking at it right now, was the paycheck plateau. If I saw that, I'm not sure I would have got to episode 2, because I don't know why we started so depressingly, but it was a very informative episode because, and this is something that I think both Rich and I, although I secretly think Rich is a 1%er and he just won't admit it on the show, anyway, have reached a curve. And in that article or in that podcast, we highlighted an article that says, life may begin at 40, but according to a number of studies, you'll plateau at 45. And so even if you, let's say I was, you know what, I'm going to work a 9-to-5 and I'm just going to do that. And that's all I want to do. It was just crazy to me how quickly you would maximize your income in most careers. 90% of lifetime earners see their earnings decline as a group after age 45, as far as wage growth goes.
So that's actually good to know.
Right.
That's true. Because then you'll be like, oh, crap, this is it. So I need some side rocket boosters to keep that income going, right? I did write a post a while ago called Over the Hill at 40, age discrimination in the workplace. And it's interesting because I wrote that when I was, 31, 32, and now I'm 40 this year. And it's really true in the sense, the reason why it's true is because I had to go to these diversity and age discrimination training every year. So I wouldn't have to do that if it wasn't true. But now that I'm 40, I'm like, man, I just want to kick back 25 hours of fun time a week, stimulate the mind, and that's it. I want to go play tennis, work out, go to the movies, eat, relax, spend time with family. I don't want to work 60 and 80 hours a week like I did in my 20s anymore. Hell no. And that's probably what a lot of people feel like as they get older. It's really natural and it's logical. And that's why there's like this discrimination in the workforce. And they're just one hungry guy, the kid who's like, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'll do anything you want, whatever you want. Yes, sir. Thank you.
And so. Yeah. And I mean, another thing, and it really didn't, it's crazy why it didn't hit me because, working in the public sector, literally, I can go online and Google every wage band from now for the next 50 years. I can plot my next 3%.
Yeah, I mean, that's so living. Depressing. That's
yeah,
good,
exactly.
That's depressing.
And one day I did it. I plugged it into Excel and I was like, is my wage done growing? Not accounting for inflation. Like, I pretty much stagnated, and it was supported by another article we highlighted. This one's from Fortune. I'll put this in the show notes, of course, folks. The typical earner can expect to see our wages grow the most between the ages of 25 and 35. By an average of 38%, which is good, but by no means mind-blowing, between 35 and 55, workers should not expect much of a bump.
Wow. So, man, that's great because I got out at age, right, three months before my 35th birthday. So that's the thing. Here's something I learned. Growth feels great. Even when you go from making $4 an hour to $6 an hour, right? You're like 50% up. You're feeling good, even though it's only $6 an hour still.
It feels game changing.
But yeah, it was amazing. But let's say you're at $100,000 a year and you get a 5% bump to $105,000. So that's way more than your $2 an hour increase. But it sucks. You're like, this sucks. Get me out of here. And if you go, it's the same thing. If you're at $500,000 and you go to like $550,000, you're like, this sucks. This is horrible, especially if some guy is, up 20% or 30%.
And it's funny. Yeah, you say that because when you were telling your Greece article, I was thinking, or excuse me, your Greece story, I was thinking, okay, if I got $1,200 at the top of a mountaintop with $10 beers, I was actually respected. Even in your story, I was like, man, he's so responsible. He bought one more beer. I'd have been like, everybody on me. And I was like, you know, that's just that discipline. That
there was
I
only two more people in the bar. two random people, and they were on a date, I think.
Hey, those two random people would have had four beers, I assure.
Yeah. So, I mean, so now, like, you know, for example, Financial Samurai, I've been around for 8 years, so the growth is not that exciting anymore. You know, last year maybe it grew 20%, 20-25%, which is nice. It's better than the S&P 500. But years before it was growing at like 100%, you know, 100% every year. And I was like, yeah, this is awesome. This is so cool. So now I've turned kind of from like a growth stock to a, dividend paying old stodgy stock, you know?
And, another thing, and I, you know, I'm laughing, maybe perhaps laughing to keep from crying here, but the reason I share this on the show is I think a lot of us don't realize it till we're at that plateau. Like I started kind of consciously thinking about it a few years ago because I was actually looking at whether I was going to go back to school, if I was going to switch jobs, and the people who've been following the show know that I did both. And at the time, I that's when I plugged into the Excel spreadsheet and I was like, wait a minute, there's 20 years accounted for here and I only see 10% of growth. This doesn't make any sense. And I started looking into it. I was like, wow, these numbers are right. But like you said, most people just go through the day to day. They get the little bumps. They get the, you know, it might be a 10%, it might be a 20%. Impressive. And yeah, that's all you collect. And then you're, you know, 35, you put 10 years in, not that there's anything wrong with that, but you're like, you know, when's my next big bump coming? You start looking through the HR chart and you're like, wait, is there any more bumps out there? There? And you want to avoid that position. Another position that you want to avoid, this came from the article. I'm really glad that you pointed this out. We didn't touch on this on our show, but I think our shocked expressions alluded to this, but the couple was saving $36,000 a year in pre-tax retirement, which I'm a fan for. I don't max out my retirement, but that's only because I cannot. Or maybe I'm not being painful enough yet.
That's what I was about to say. That he's been now. More I'm sitting pain. Here, yeah, and I'm like, huh? I haven't felt like true struggle in the last couple of months. You know what? I need to make this hurt.
Yeah, make it hurt. Come back to me in a couple of months. Tell me how much pain you guys are in. And well, then after another month of that, you'll be like, oh, there's no more pain. And then you put that pain again, you press, you turn the screws.
Well, I mean, what drove it home here is with the monthly expense of $22,000, I'll just round it up, to maintain their lifestyle. And then you ask rhetorically, can you guess how many more years they need to save at their place, this pace to maintain a similar lifestyle? Another 63 years. And they were, I think in the story, they're already in their 30s.
Yeah, so, you know, they'll be good at 100.
Yeah, I think that's another dynamic people don't consider. Not only, okay, let's say you did want to stay on this path. Yeah. How much longer would you have to work just to sustain it?
Yeah, nobody's going to want to stay on their path for more than 10 years. I'm serious. I've talked to so many people. It's like, you know, I talked to the 25-year-old bright-eyed, bushy-tailed person. I love my job. I hate, you know, you should live more. Come on. And then, like, you know, I've been around for 8 years now. So now they're like 32 and they're like, oh, Sam, God, I hate my job. I got to get out. I should have listened to you. This sucks. Help me. And now I got my nice autoresponder. Hi. If I don't know who you are, I probably won't respond because I get too many emails. But thanks so much for your email.
That was the most honest autoresponder that I've ever read in my life. I was like, huh, this is extremely thorough. You know what, Marcus? Maybe we should create something like this. And
yeah, it made us feel good because literally that same week we had just started our autoresponder. And I felt bad because, you know, usually it's just Rich and I. There's like no, well, there's Rich, I, and Tim. There's like not some huge conglomerate behind Paychecks and Balances. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, we're losing that personal touch, Rich. What if we don't see and touch every email responder?
Just write a personal autoresponder.
Yes, I did. And I hope that people like it, and it has freed up so many more minutes.
There you go.
And hours of my week.
Yeah.
So, Rich, did you have a follow-up there?
If I did, I forgot what it was by taking a drink of water, so I'm just gonna take my seat and just put my ear near the microphone. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Anyway, go on, Marcus.
And also from the article, and we started going through some of the comments you had because the people have already heard from us. So if there's anything else that you want to expand on. But to this point, you say, for those of you who are super ambitious or ready to implement the pain from today's show, it's worth working your butt off to see how far you can go in your career. But if you get a multiple six-figure income, I guess actually any income, shoot to last for 10 years while saving 50% or more of your after-tax income, not under 10% like this couple. Any additional thoughts on that?
The additional thoughts are longevity is kind of key. You know, you don't want to have ADHD in your career where you're just job hopping everywhere because everything sounds better, which is what I'm seeing right now over the past 5 years. I don't know, maybe it's a generational thing, whatever. But nobody's sticking in their careers for longer than 2 to 3 years, at least here in the Bay Area. I think there's so much opportunity. But if you can stick out anything for 10 years, so when I started Financial Samurai in 2009, I told myself, all right, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to stick it out until 2019 and then revisit. I think good things happen if you can stick to anything for 10 years. Your side hustle, you know, your entrepreneurial activities, your job. Just stick through it. And if you're saving 50%, that means every year you save is 1 year of expenses you cover. So 10 years of 50% savings is 10 years of further financial freedom.
That 10-year marker is so important. And it's part of the reason I asked you about when did things really start moving with the blog, because right now we're in this on-demand generation where people want things to happen so quickly. They try something for a few months, it doesn't work. Also, yeah. even in terms of the career, I realized Marcus and I, we've both been working over 10 years now. And I think about some of the recent inflection points that I hit where I'm just kind of like, wow, is this really what I want to do for the rest of my life? No. How can I make more impact? And I've just found as I've gotten older, and I think this happens with everyone, we start moving more toward, and some people may not say legacy per se, but we start thinking, how can I do a better job of fulfilling my purpose or feel that I'm doing more purposeful work?
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. Try to think in 5-year blocks. If you do anything, try to shoot for 5 years or 4 years, because, you know, high school is 4 years, college is 4 to 5 years. If you can think in these type of blocks and commit, really good things happen. And there's another thing that I like to tell people is that, you know, hard work requires no skill. So I'm not a really smart guy. I didn't get great grades. You know, my SAT scores weren't great. So I already knew that I wasn't academically or intelligently gifted at all. So I said, I got to do something to make up for that. So I decided to work hard. And it was just that simple, because there's no skill, no intelligence involved in working hard. And so if you can just keep on that path for 5-year block, 10-year block, I'm certain something positive will happen. Too many people give up way before something is allowed to positively happen to them.
Yeah. And that, yeah. I was just real quick, and then Marcus, I know we're rounding toward the finish here, and I'm reminded of a story. I think it was in Think and Grow Rich, where the two people were digging for gold, and they dug for a long time and then gave up, not knowing that they were literally, I think, like inches away from finally striking gold, and then someone else comes in and picks up the victory because they didn't stick with it. I think it's a similar idea here, what you're saying in terms of the 5-year blocks, that no matter what you do, it's going to take time and it's probably going to suck along the way. You're going to feel that pain you were talking about, but there's always going to be some type of payoff at the end there. So
yeah. And the growth in the beginning is actually the most fun. So you just got to stick with it. I don't know if anybody plays golf, but if you're like a 20 handicap, it's actually really fun because you can get better. But if you're like an 8 handicap, it's actually not that fun because you always have to be on in regulation. One missed putt and your day is ruined. So just cherish that growth, cherish that beginning, because that sooner or later will fade too. And you're going to be like just a steady state where there's not that much growth. And then you're going to be like, oh, what's next? So for me, I'm 8 years in. I got 2 more years and then I'm done. No more writing. That's it. I disappear forever, just like Kaiser Soze, you know?
Nice.
So I think another thing that we hear a lot, I got two comments in, as Rich said, we can to move to the wrap up here, is I heard this recently, and I think it's maybe all interrelated. I've been going to these training sessions, most of them free because I'm cheap. And one of the comments that were made there, and he was like, time is, and everybody yelled money. Time is money. And like, because it was actually a financial conference. Everybody was so excited. He was like, wrong. Time is precious and money is money. I mean, you can always make more money. You cannot make more time. Yep. And then he asked, how much money does it take to buy time? And I think we're taught these you know, quote unquote, the American dream and quote unquote, these fallacies. And they sound good. They look great on bumper stickers, but they are incorrect. And that's actually a good segue to, I was going to ask you your most shocking revelation from, you know, all of this, this article, or maybe even the second part, or maybe just from running Financial Samurai in general, but I have to give mine first. And actually a listener corrected me and I appreciate them for doing so. Mm. A Toyota Land Cruiser is $84,000. What?
Like, did I say that? Did I write 84,000?
No, I didn't know that. So they had a BMW 5 and it said Toyota Land Cruiser. Yeah, I'm thinking like $30,000 vehicle.
No,
I kind of dismissed it. I am not going to lie.
Come on.
I saw Toyota and I dismissed
it. It's like 84 to 90,000. MSRP 84,000. The median car price now is 34,000, which is also ridiculous since the per capita GDP is like 42,000 gross. So after tax, people are spending their entire after-tax salary on a car. That's crazy. But there's another topic to talk about.
I will say I walked into work after that episode came out, and I definitely got checked on the Land Cruiser like twice. They were like, by the way, great episode, but did you know that? And I'm like, yeah, I know multiple people have told us. And we also had a lot of people tell us that 10,000 in close for two lawyers actually isn't that much. But then that got me to thinking that a career is actually a discretionary income choice, but that's also an episode for another day. So Marcus, I'm gonna let you cook.
Well, I'm pretty sure, I mean, I was gonna hold those back. A couple of listeners, you know, and we appreciate all comments, but I'm pretty sure they called us broke or put us in our place, and rightfully so, because I don't know anything about Toyota Land Cruisers apparently. Other than I will never buy one now. So what was your most, if there was one, shocking revelation or that you learned?
I love how everybody judges other people. I think it's really fascinating as a writer. What we do is we project what our money beliefs are onto other people, and how so many people say, I would never spend that on my kids while they don't have kids and they're not married. Or I would never... I would never buy that car. Whereas they, on a percentage level of what they own in terms of their vehicle versus their income, is like way bigger than what this $500,000 couple is spending. And I think it's just awesome to see the judgment and all that stuff from Twitter. It's like one big social experiment. And it goes back to, again, control what you can control, because whatever you shade on other people, whatever, is not going to help you. You just have to figure out what you value, and you have to have your financial systems in place. And the other takeaway is people see what they want to see. You know, people will probably just say scraping by in $500,000 a year, how, you know, high income earners can't escape the rat race, and then just judge on the comment. They don't bother to look at the substance of the article and go through the details. So if you are a rich person hater, you're always going to hate rich people no matter what. And if you are a rich person sympathizer, you're going to say, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, yeah, kids are expensive. Taxes suck. It's progressive tax system, whatever. So we'll see what we want to see. Just try not to be too blind about your blind spots.
Nice, nice. Rich, any revelations that you want to share?
I'm with that on the judgmental piece. And I think the internet wouldn't have it any other way. And a lot of times when it comes to articles like this, or any story, I do believe people look for a reason to be upset, to be mad, to judge. And I also think that's a good reason that reality TV does so well. It's pretty much judgment central. Like all throughout the week, I can always tell what show on based off of the type of shade that I see being thrown. But the amount of judgment and comparison is rampant, and I'm not surprised by that. But I guess
So at 500,000, by definition, less than 1% make 500,000 in America, right? So therefore, it's 99% pontificators on what it's like to earn 500,000, and then judge, right? But so that's why I just want people to know also, like, there are people who make 500,000. Like, you know, if you're a janitor on the San Francisco BART Muni Station.
I saw that news story out here, by the way.
Yeah, and you marry, a BART electrician, elevator technician, your combined income is about 500,000, for example, right? and not just two lawyers, two bankers, one banker, VC guy. Actually, there's a lot of people who make similar types of income, but they're all actually in hiding, right? they don't want anybody knowing what's up. So there's like this reverse, hey, what's up? This is me. This is like a reverse selfie kind of culture where the more you make, the more you go in hiding, because people see the judgment that's out there from people who don't make what they make and they couldn't fathom. And so this is all about stealth wealth. And I think stealth wealth is a great movement that people should adopt to be more humble, to be more giving, to be more cognizant. That not everybody is as lucky as you are to make this type of money if you make this type of money. Mm. And just not to bling out, because just bad things happen.
I'll readily admit I will throw myself on the mercy of the podcast. Another thing that I think made this article, which compliments to you, I mean, for this article, not only to stand the test of time, but to come up again later in time, was fear. And that fear is, let's say I did, through some miracle, because I can't even figure out what that pathway is right now. Maybe I need to marry a Bart janitor, apparently. But yeah, let's say I want to, you know, we're trying to make our way up to 500,000. So all of us, we're all striving towards that 1%. I think there's an underlying fear that is unspoken that, wow, I could get there and still struggle.
Yeah, I mean.
And that's, that's not comforting.
well, here's the thing. What is comforting is one of the things I wanted to do is tell people, hey, don't bother trying to get to the 500,000 level, because this couple is spending all their money and I don't think they're any happier. And frankly, they might be even more miserable than the person who has, the normal $50,000, $80,000 a year job that's much more leisurely, pays less taxes, can spend more time with family and do things. And the stress is crazy, because I was in this industry for 13 years. The stress is crazy. Like every month, how'd you do? Every quarter, you know, what have you done for me lately? And, you know, I had back pain, sciatica, allergies, you know, tennis elbow. This is like chronic pain. And then once I got out, I was like, wow, this is actually how life is supposed to be. Actually, I'm pain-free life. I didn't know that for 13 years. And so I really want people to second guess this crazy desire for money and prestige and power. It's all the same. It's actually worse. Don't bother. Let's go to Europe. Go to Canada. Go to Australia. You know, the Aussies, they're like so chill. After college, you know, they go for like this walkabout for like 1 year where they just go see the world. And they're always happy. They're drinking beer. And they also have the highest inheritance level per person in the whole world. I think it's like 180,000. It's like 60, 70, 80,000 more than the average American. Huh. So they're the richest per capita and per inheritance. And they're also like the happiest. Same thing with like Norway and Sweden. Those guys are always the happiest countries in the world. And they don't make that much and they have massive taxes, but that's because they have a really nice and balanced life.
I can't really debate that.
Yeah. And it's not about me, but I literally, it's like a cartoon. I talked about this on a few shows ago. I'm trying to ignore it. It's probably like something really bad. I don't want to look it up on WebMD. My eye only twitches at work. Only. Mm-hmm. I go to work and like I get into a stressful situation. My eye twitches. It doesn't twitch anytime on the weekend unless I'm thinking about work.
Really?
I've ignored it for a few years.
You know what? It's only, you said only one eye, right? So wait until one the other eye starts twitching.
That's when it's time to get out.
I'm scared that when the other eye twitches, they're both just going to close. So as far as wrap up goes, is there any social media or projects that you want to hit, you want to share with the people?
No, just come to financialsamurai.com. If you want to harass me or yell at me, or feel free, just try to be logical in your argument, have some really good stuff behind it, and just leave a comment, and just explore the site and have fun. You know, the site is there to be really open and to learn from each other and to keep an open mind. You know, don't take things too seriously. There's no right or wrong way. There's some guidelines that I feel are helpful. But again, if the direction is correct, sooner or later you'll get there. So best of luck to everybody.
Definitely. Yeah. And I can say just from perusing the site and looking around, there's also a lot of dialogue there. So it's very clear that you've built a community over all of these years, people who are really passionate about the topics that you're talking about. And I'm sure some of the people on the drive-by read one article, came through, told you they hate you, threw a tomato, and they bounced. but
nobody did that. Come on.
Yeah, so
that was one love on financial settlement.
Oh, of course. We're going to officially wrap this up, and thanks to everyone for listening to this convo. Thanks again, Sam.
Thanks, guys.